You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the new episode of 2026 for the EU Startups Podcast. I'm your new host. My name is David Sendon Garcia. I'm the news editor here at EU Startups. I'll be taking on the duties for the podcast from the previous host, Marcin Lewandowski, who's moved on to greater and better things. If you want to learn more about that, you should watch our previous episode on the paddle court. In this episode, I'm joined by Friedrich Schwandt, who's the founder of ECDB and Statista. He spent nearly the last 2 decades building what is arguably one of the most widely used data platforms before stepping into a chairman role in 2024 and launching his next venture in e-commerce data. In this episode, we're going to be talking about scaling Statista from the small Hamburg startup that it was into the global business that it became, knowing when it's time to hand over the reins, lessons for founders, and how AI is changing the game for companies that work with data, as well as our mutual love for Ireland and his fondness for card games. But before, a quick segment from our sponsor.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vonta comes in. Vonta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vonta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vonta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vonta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Well, hello, Friedrich. Thank you very much for joining me on this very special podcast for me. We're very happy to have you on, and we're very interested, really, in hearing about your entrepreneurial journey and everything you've done so far. I was hoping that we could begin just with you presenting yourself, your name, and just your career, and kind of give the audience an idea of who you are before we get into the meat of the questions.
Sure. First of all, thank you very much for having me on the podcast, and my career. It's relatively easy to describe. I started, as so many, as a consultant. I worked for BCG for a couple of years, then basically felt I wanted to start something, but was a young father, so I was extremely risk averse. So I started my own consultancy. I knew what I was doing. And then in 2007, I basically decided consultancy, that's nice, and you give other people advice, but at some point, I wanted to be bold enough to do something proper. And I somehow didn't consider consultancy not a proper job, although I did it for so many years. And then basically did something which I had some knowledge. I studied economics and statistics and did it. And so started Statista. And that was in, I think, we planned everything in 2007, then launched the business in 2008 until 2022. I basically managed Statista. And then, but I would say 6-7 years before we sold it to a major company, but actually we were in a very, very good relationship with the people who bought it. So we said, we stay on. Plus, to be honest, it was the first time we really had money. Before Statista, I mean, the story of Statista was we always were lacking money. I mean, constantly. And it is almost like a drug addict. You don't have any drugs. And at then some point you get money. So we could invest, could roll it out. And that was so much fun for us. So we normally, when you sell something, you stay there 2 years. So we stayed a couple of more years. And then in 2022, we decided, okay, now it's time to start something new. Mm. because we were interested and think it's always great to start something new. And then we founded ECDB. And ECDB is basically, again, a data business, but at the moment focusing on e-commerce and soon on the entire transaction business.
Okay. Yes, because the acquisition was in 2015, I want to say, if I have my notes right, Statista.
That sounds right.
Yes, yes. Well, and I can relate to your. I also worked in consultancy for a while. I can relate to that kind of want of, you know, getting out and doing your own thing. So it's very admirable and very interesting, really, the entire journey so far. And I guess before we really get into that, I think it's interesting for all of our audience to kind of hear about the early days, you know, before even Statista was an idea in your head, because as I understand it, you spent time in a Deutsche Telekom and BCG. So, but before Statista, I was just wondering if you had a moment where you can remember that you realized that data could actually become your life's work, data, numbers, all of these things. What was the moment that led into that?
And I always admire people who have first the vision and then decide to do something. With me, it was exactly the opposite. I basically decided in 2007, I want to switch. I want to start a new business. Yeah. And I went out and told everyone. Sorry, and that was the very early days of startup. So I told everyone I will have a startup, and now I'm there. And of course, people ask, but what are you doing? And then you realize, well, you really need an idea. Whereas I always loved first the idea to be a startup entrepreneur. And then what I did is very typical for a consultant. We came up with about 100 ideas. Yeah, what would be good? And one was a fashion label. And another one was start a coffee chain. Starbucks hasn't been in Europe yet. And once we went through all the ideas, I realized maybe it's a good idea, but it wouldn't be me. You know, I mean, if you can see me, my tailor is called Uniqlo, so I'm really not into fashion. And so hence, I always believe you should do something where you feel that you really know what your customers want, mm-hmm. what the problem of your customers is, so you don't have to research. It almost comes naturally to you.
Hmm.
And to me, the only thing of the 100 ideas came naturally to me were data and statistics. And then we said, okay, let's think about it for a second. And we felt there was a problem we could solve. We felt there was a willingness to pay for data. We felt it sounded actually pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided, okay, let's start with Statista.
Okay. Yeah, well, not to age anybody, but I remember when I was in high school, if you turned in a good paper where you were quoting Statista, you got a good grade, because it was seen as you actually did your research and you actually got real numbers. And so it's been ever present, I think, in at least a younger generation of our lives, even not just talking about such heavy set data sectors, but even things like education. It's shown up, you know, in our lives.
It was two stories around that. Mm. One was, I remember when at the beginning of Statista, we did a couple of presentations and as well at universities. And at the beginning, you always ask, has everybody heard of Statista? And you had an audience of 100, 200 people, and there were basically two people who said, yes, we have heard of it. Mm. And then at the end, I remember that I asked a question, and then a colleague of mine said, Fredrik, you shouldn't ask this question anymore. It's a stupid question. Everybody knows it. And of course, there's these few moments where you say, okay, we did it. And then another story was I met a couple of professors because I was always in sales. So I presented to university library. And I really remember this professor looking with a very angry face and saying, we hate you, we hate you. Why do you hate me? Well, basically, all our tasks, everything is, the people go to Statista, they take all the data presented, and they don't do anything more on their own. And I said, that's good. Hate is emotion, and emotion is always a good indicator that you created something powerful.
No, of course. And even past education, I began, and I will touch on this later, but I began my career in Ireland at the Irish Independent in Dublin, as a fast news journalist. And there we'd begin with Statista if we're talking about data. Of course, you know, it's our jobs to go further on that and to get the reality behind things. But even then, Statista is ever present. I think it's even past the point of just being company. It's kind of a staple. You know, it's a reference point. So in that sense, I really do think it's here to stay. Not that you need me to tell you, but it's infiltrated, I think, just about every data analysis outlook that we have out there. You sort of touched on this, but I want to ask it very directly. That when you began, what would you say was the problem that you were looking at? What was the thing that you were trying to provide a solution for? You said that it was an interest of yours, obviously, data, and a passion. But what was would you say the goal to solve? Was it to the absence of data?
I would say data and statistics were, of course, even before the internet, I mean, we were talking about the beginning of the, they were somehow present. But I remember as a consultant, you always developed a story. Yeah, you wanted to show something, you write down the headlines, and then you say, okay, now I have to find data to prove what I think is the good story. Mm. And in those days, I actually went through newspapers, et cetera, and cut out some graphs and said, oh, that would be nice to put there. And then I said, there must be an easier way instead of going through a newspaper surfing around. Mm. And so we had two ideas to say, and as I said, it's not original. I mean, I think Statista is almost obvious. Yeah. And I need a place where people can go and they can find statistics and data on all relevant business topics.
Mm-hmm.
And the data should be somehow reliable.
Mm-hmm.
That is idea number one, because it just saves time instead of surfing around. And second, the data should be prepared in a way that's easy to use. You know, it not just, oh, I have to copy it and then I have to put it into Excel and then I have to generate my own data. But you basically have 3-4 different formats. You just click on it, mainly PowerPoint and Excel, and then people can use it. These were the two ideas. And I think the two ideas were strong enough really then to drive the whole thing. And what was interesting in those days, there was once a discussion in journalism, is everything paid by advertising or paid content? And in 2007, basically paid content was something people talked about it as in a theoretical concept, but more like, and then we go to Mars and we can live on it. I mean, people have heard about it. It sounds nice, but no one really takes it serious. Everything was advertising, finance, because it was so many possibilities and so much easier.
Yeah.
And of course, what we did was saying, oh, no, people are willing to pay for statistics and for data because they buy all these reports. Mm-hmm. And then why shouldn't they pay directly to us? And so that worked actually nicely.
Yeah, well, it even sounds like you were ahead of the curve on that kind of thinking, which turned out.
There was always the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times who focus on, but the rest, even the Independent, if I remember correctly, in Ireland, they focus very much on advertising instead of paid content.
Yeah, no, I believe they do. Well, and now fast forward, you spent over 17 years, if I did the math correctly. Yeah. You're as CEO. Right now, the site covers over 80,000 topics. So it's grown at an incredible pace, even during that time period. What would you say was kind of the hardest growth moment that maybe people don't really realize when looking at such a successful company like Statista?
I think it is typical. It is probably with many projects always the beginning and the end. That at the beginning, we had the two main challenges. Number one, we were, as I said, totally underfinanced. Mm-hmm. So in our entire career, we raised 1 million euros to build a company which later had 1,500 employees and offices, etc. And the rest was always coming out of our own cash flow. So a typical year for me at the beginning was always, oh, it's January. Let's plan how many people we have to sack in order to survive. It never happened.
Okay.
But basically, just that you have the mindset is we start, it will be extremely difficult And then somehow we made it through the year, and then the next year came. But so step number, and so why 2008, we had basically the breakdown of the stock market and all the problems, and all the VCs and disappeared for a couple of years. And so the only thing what we get were this 1 million in order to finance what we wanted to do. And then the second biggest challenge was for me after Corona. Corona was for us actually a good day time. I mean, people realized all the companies, they need to work from home. They need to have access to all the database. So that was an easy sell. I mean, we prospered under during Corona. But then when we came back to the office, for me, there was this double effect. On one hand, all the employees expected, oh, I can work from everywhere. It's totally virtual, totally freedom.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, Statista has grown so much to 1,500 people. It was more a corporate organization. And it is something strange when employees work in a large organization, they behave differently. It is just, when you're a small organization, you really feel everyone is focusing on the company, the success, etc. When you're a larger organization, slowly people become more and more focused on self-optimizing. It is almost like a law which happens. And this combination of being really large, plus I want to work for everywhere. It has worked during Corona. People constantly said, oh, you know, a modern company is a virtual company, etc. That was very, very tough to manage.
Yeah.
Because I strongly believe that, and maybe there are exceptions, I mean, but the majority of companies I've run, you need to work together in a place where you, when you discuss things, where you develop things, you can't do it constantly via Teams. It is just not, people are not made for it.
But that does seem to be kind of a make or break moment for a lot of companies as transition from this, as you're saying, the startup mindset of everyone's got a unified goal, everyone has an idea, everything that's happening. And then when you grow the way you did, being able to adapt and being able to make it work within a larger organization. And as you said, a corporate organization, I think that's that leads us nicely into the next question I have about.
And let me say, to 1,000 people, I still feel you can manage. But really, if you go one over 1,000, it becomes so large that you don't know the names of everybody. And it just is a different organization. And so I do admire people who manage 100,000, 200,000 people. I mean, that's wow.
Right. Do you have an idea of how many employees are in Statista right now?
I think for the moment, it's not anymore growing as fast as before. So I believe 1,400, 1,300.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, the idea of that corporate structure, I want to hear, if you don't mind, kind of flashing back here a little bit. As we mentioned, Deutsche Telekom, BCG. I was wondering just if those early corporate years, what they prepared you for, and maybe what didn't they prepare you for? Maybe it helped with this kind of transition phase where you understood, having worked in a larger company, the dynamics, and maybe what didn't work on that same level.
No. Let's first start. I do admire people who start a company when they're 25, 27, etc. Yeah. And I notice a majority of the company they start, I would say, have a B2C focus because they understand students. So they say, okay, I can build something for my peers for this age. Really? I do believe that if you want to earn money, it makes always sense to consider a B2B focus. It is easier actually to launch companies in a B2B area because it's so much larger and there's so much more money and willingness to pay. Private consumers are actually quite difficult to manage over. But in order to address the B2B market, I do believe you need some knowledge. I mean, maybe you're a genius, which I'm definitely not, but if you're a genius, you can imagine what they want. But otherwise, you need some kind of experience. And so I believe what helped me really to understand how large organizations work, which people you have to address if you want to come to a decision, what the problems are they have, how do they manage their budget, etc. That is very helpful. have they prepared me anything in how do you build a product and et cetera? Not at all. I mean, that is basically, we learned it by ourselves and we tried out, but yeah. That is a little bit more self-educated.
I think this entrepreneur journey you're talking about is very relevant for most of our audience, really. I imagine most of them are going through the same thing at different stages that you've talked about, but you seem to kind of have addressed these challenges and still come out on top, which I think is useful for just about anybody listening to this. So we've covered Statista, and now what do you
say? And if I may add, so as you can see, I'm slightly older than you right now, and so I have a son, which is slightly. You have really to look deep. But I have a son now who is 22 and will soon start working, and a daughter who has just started. And they both asked me what would be my opinion, because at some point, of course, they would like to try out to have a startup. And of course, I recommended to them, I mean, first really learn 3, 4, 5 years, a business, work for other companies. And I think then you're ready in order to try out certain things.
Yes, I agree completely. And I think it is a good basis for any success, really, if any company. You need to have that real world experience, you need to have been able to have experienced other leadership styles, been under a different umbrella to kind of be able to make your own. So that's Statista. Incredible. So why don't we move on to the big letters behind you, as you very so well have positioned them. In 2024, is it 2024 or 2023 that you stepped down as CEO from Statista?
I believe in 2023.
2023. Okay, so in 2023, you stepped down as CEO and moved into chairman position. What was that like? Was it a difficult process? Was it maybe relieving to let go of that kind of day-to-day control? And how did you know that it was also time for you to maybe make that progress and step aside and let a new leadership step forward?
At first start, was it a difficult one or was it an easy one? And of course, the answer is both. Yeah, at some point, different people manage differently and they get, but for me, I always feel responsible for a company. And if you have responsibility, it comes automatically a little bit of pressure. So on one hand, it was fantastic. I was not any more responsible in order to generate the salary for 1,500 people. And you feel really relieved I took my job serious, and if you take your job serious. And on the other hand, it's, of course, next to my two children, it's my baby, and that you let go, and now someone else managed it. So it was difficult. Then I asked myself if I would be CEO and had a chairman, what kind of chairman I would like to have. Would I like someone who's constantly basically telling other people what to do? Do I want someone who's very present, where I have to worry he's still a power in this decision process? And of course, the answer is no. Yeah. You want someone you can go to, you can ask questions, you try that he be as objective as possible, but otherwise you want him out. I mean, that is how people think. And I believe CEOs, when they are CEOs of larger companies, power and how to manage power is always something important. I mean, it comes with the job. And so that is what I did. I decided I don't want to be present anymore. So I basically avoided being in the building. I wanted to tell him whenever you want to have any kind of questions, we proposed to him certain topics, we took over certain tasks, but we were basically, coming back to my old days, good consultants, good advisors, but really out of the role. Because, and on the other hand, I told him, now you're CEO, all the problems are your problems. I have nothing to do with it at all. and of course, that's a joke because, as you know, there's so much legacy and everything. Of course, you inherit quite a lot of problems. But that is how I played it. And I would do it exactly the same way.
And of course, that let you then move on your attempt into ECDB, which we'll get into. And I read your LinkedIn post, actually, when this was announced. I thought there's an interesting idea that I want to touch on there was the 33%. So you said 33% I can now dedicate to chairman of Statista, 33% I can now dedicate to this new endeavor, ECDB, and 33% I can dedicate to my own personal life, my family, my own hobbies. What tell me about that balance. Is that something maybe that you felt had been lacking up to that point, or is that something that you just feel is important to always have detailed and outlined as you go forward with a new venture?
And first of all, of course, that was a dream. Yeah, I mean, that is a young man thinking for a moment I could be independent, etc. I work as much as before, and there's basically nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely nothing. And it's good like this. I mean, if you're really into it, it is more. I mean, you do it anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is not work. It is more a big passion of yours. Mm-hmm. So, but nice. There was one or two moments where I dreamed I could do something else but just work. Mm-hmm. I think what was important for me was more like really saying, okay, I shouldn't dedicate too much time to Statista because I was still because then you never get it out of your system. And that is, I think, important. So a little bit of structure helps.
Mm.
Beside that, I would say when I started ECDB right away, I was totally into it.
Mm. And I have to ask, what is, and I'm going to check my notes here.
Please.
Doppelkopf.
That is, it's really interesting. Normally we have a totally international culture nowadays. But then if you look, are there certain things which are very specific for certain countries and they still exist. And so we have a card game which doesn't exist outside of, actually we have a couple. And it just, I have... four or five actually very, very good friends still from old school days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of high school. And it happened to be that we live in Hamburg all together, although I grew up in Hanover, but no one stays in Hanover. It's like Galway. You always probably go to Dublin with few exceptions. But so long story short, and we're here. And so that is actually fun because when we're together, we constantly forget what everybody's doing, and it just a lot of jokes and back to the old school days, and okay. That's top.
Well, I hope you've been able to dedicate some time to that as well. Then.
A little bit. No. I nothing to complain.
Good. Well, let's fully move into ECDB then. Same question with Statista. I put it here now. What was that problem that you were looking to solve?
Statista is easy to understand. So what is ECDB? Simple one. First of all, ECDB is short for e-commerce database.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, because I'm very much into movies, there's something called IMDB, and which was Internet Movie Database. And I said, isn't that Internet Movie Database a bit too long? E-commerce database, I feel as well. So we said ECDB. And typically with four letters, it takes a while. People get used to it. And once they're there, they accept it for. So that's it. The basic idea behind it is the following. If you analyze the internet and the business models behind it, then you find out that 75% of all the business models are transaction business models, meaning you as a private customer pay money to companies. Yeah. And interestingly, or everybody is constantly talking about the internet and all the different business models, it's actually quite intransparent to understand how different companies evolve, how different markets evolve, etc. Because you have some stock-listed companies and they publish some data, but extremely limited. Example, a company called Amazon, they're very much into e-commerce. They publish, that's how much we make in the US and that's how much we make outside of the US. But that's it. They're so dominant. They don't publish anything about the different countries, how much is 1P, 3P, etc., etc., etc. So you have all these large companies, all these businesses, but people don't really know how they're developing on a monthly or even annual, on a monthly or even daily basis. And our idea was, is there not a way how we can bring transparency into this market for benchmarking, for business opportunities, etc. And the idea was very simple. Well, when people pay, of course, then you have all the data for the transactions. Why don't we buy everywhere these all these transactions and analyze them? Because I know who is paying, I know the amount, at what time, etc., etc. And so people don't know this, but there is actually, you can go to MasterCard, to banks, etc., and buy the transactions. You don't get the name behind it, and that's absolutely right. You shouldn't. But you get all the single transactions. And that's what we do. We buy, so for all the Western European countries, or for North America and for some Asian countries, all these transactions. It's really the billion, what we say, transaction. And we go through it, then allocate them to all the different stores and markets. And out of this and a couple of other sources, we calculate how all these businesses and retailers and markets evolve.
Okay. I think you're very right in terms of, you know, data is digital gold in the era that we live in. Even for us here at EU Startups, data journalism forms a huge part of what we do. Our database in terms of where we register funding rounds, acquisitions like that, that's really a huge part of our value offering. Is that we can kind of give this kind of record as to how things are going, where they've been, where they might be going. That kind of analysis is deeply needed. To what level? And I imagine this is a question that's going to pop up in every single podcast interview I do, is how is AI changing that? How is this automation affecting your industry?
That is a good one. There is, because of course the question is, on two levels, is AI a threat, first of all, and is it a tool which can help us?
Yeah.
Let's start with a threat. When we thought about ECDB, we basically thought in which cases we believe AI could be a threat and in which cases not. And so we asked, I believe if you're a generalist, then AI can be a threat. If you're extremely specialized on something, it is more difficult to attack. I believe if you aggregate data, it could be a threat. If you have your own database, again, it is easier to defend. If your data is just changes on an annual basis, difficult. If your data changes, you publish on a daily basis, more difficult. So we looked for a business where we're super specialized. We have our own business model, and which where we change the data on a regular basis. So I believe on the threat basis, I mean, you never know what happens with all the LLMs, et cetera, but to my understanding for the moment, I don't see that they can substitute us in any way.
Yeah.
Now, on the tool basis, there are many ways. For us, LLMs are fantastic alternative access to data. If you think about how can you use data, typically, you start with this an interface like a tool, and we did this. And the next step is I want to have an API, so I can basically abstract or take all the data. And the third one is I want to have my own LLM where basically can ask questions and then basically get direct answers and almost reports out of the system. And we use all three things. So for us as well, how we collect and calculate AI tools are extremely helpful.
I'm actually shocked at how much what you're saying applies to my own views in journalism, which I won't expand on because that's not what this podcast is about. But this idea of it's a threat on how general your focus is, that's when it registers as a threat, I think is very applicable also to the current journalism landscape.
100%.
Yeah.
And there are many companies who still produce quite a lot of reports. I mean, companies such as Mintel, Euromonitor, etc. And I believe that is not sustainable because you go to it and you get such good answers. And you can see over the last 3-4 months how the quality has improved. I mean, it's enormous. So I believe all these companies have and will change.
Well, we'll keep our eyes out. See how that affects them. I want to kind of do a question for our audience. I'll put it that way. And I'm putting it to you, but I think they would be interested in hearing anybody who's a founder, anybody's an entrepreneur, just that after all of these years of building two different companies, different focuses, what's a mistake that you might see current founders committing? What is something that you, if you could give a piece of advice to them, what's something that you would lead with?
I think I would turn it a little bit around. I'm not sure if I'm able to tell them what their mistakes are because, hey, who am I? Sure. I can tell you what's important to me when I started both companies. And that is, first of all, I think it's extremely challenging to be an entrepreneur and a founder. I mean, and so I always did it with someone who basically, now it sounds corny, but completed me in a certain way. And I would always recommend it to do it as a team. Because very few people besides Mr. Bezos and maybe Mr. Zuckerberg, but very few people are really good enough to do it on their own. And second, it is so much more fun because you have someone to talk about it and exchange ideas. And I mean, it's not, I think the fun part is important. So if you share a problem, obviously, et cetera, et cetera. Second.
And it's actually,
I believe the majority of entrepreneurs focus very much on product, but don't have too much experience in sales. And always think, well, and then it happens automatically. Either they come to my website or I have a couple of people and they just phone people. And sales is so much more. Actually, sales becomes more and more almost like a science. So I would really recommend to spend a lot of time in sales and actually ask yourself as a founder, you should sell at least for many years. So really realize how difficult it is, get the feedback of all the people. So many people underestimate sales, how important it is. And sales is changing for the moment dramatically. I mean, with all the AI tools, you can basically record everything, analyze everything. It is just fantastic. The third thing is, I'm in the data business, but I always felt, especially in Germany, people, when they developed business model, were very much focusing on little Germany. Now, for me, it was really helpful when we internationalized, our first market was the US. And I told always myself and the people, when you go to the US, tell yourself that you are someone from Kazakhstan. I mean, that you're in the real mind. No one knows about Germany. No one cares about Germany. It is really a totally small, irrelevant little country. And I feel people focus too much on their little countries, you know, as in there I can succeed. Whereas if you have a successful business, people will copy it directly and attack it. And the funding is so much better in the US. So you really should think, how can I be an international company and globalize it.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I think, and it's not a difficult point, but it's something we have to tackle here at EU Startups constantly. Because as you've said, funding is larger in the US, as there's a lot of European companies who go to the US, who make headquarters in the US for different reasons. And that's a continuous point of our coverage here. Of that kind of flow and that kind of decision making of how do you approach an internalization of a European company? Is it a full adoption of the US? Is it a patriotism of European ideals and you want to stay here with European funds? I think what you're saying is valid. I think anybody kind of facing that will
correct. And it depends on your business, but I felt for us it was very helpful to go first directly to the US. And of course, the first 2-3 years were a disaster because we thought, hey, we speak some kind of English. They must be similar to us, the same, they decide the same way. So why can't we be successful? And then learn so many things which are so different in the US and then build a business there. And once you did that, I think then it's easier typically to go to the US, Singapore, etc.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think we've gotten to the quick fire round, and we like to do this just a kind of a, you know, small sentence here, just to kind of get through some quick ideas and just to shine light on you as a person, really, because we've talked so much about your career and your achievements, but maybe we get a little bit personal here. I think the very first one is, and I think it's an important question, is what's one lesson you wish you'd learned before becoming a CEO?
I'm not sure if I wished I learned it before, but what I realized was how much more complicated it was to start a company and how much more stressful it was than I thought beforehand. So that was the first 3-4 years, I was really in the red zone constantly as a person. But as I said, I'm not sure if should I have known it before, would I ever have started company or not? But that was surprising.
I imagine that's something you can't really know without starting a company as well. I can't imagine that's a lesson you'd be able to
teach you without. 100%. You would hear it, but you would say, nah, not me. I'm much better. I can manage it. No, no one can.
Okay. Well, during this process, what's a book, a newspaper, a habit, something you've keep coming back to throughout your career that's kind of remained a constant?
I have a habit which is a bit borderline, to be honest. I have a white piece of paper and I write down my to-do list. I don't have any tools, but I really write every morning the 10 things I would like to achieve. And it gives me extremely pleasure to go through the day and say, check, check. And of course, many things need more than a day, but I formulate them in a way that I feel I achieved something. So after we finish the podcast, I go back and say, check. And I would say the advantage of it is it makes you very clear in the morning what are the 5 or 10 things I would like to achieve. Plus, as I said, you need to build something which gives you pleasure and you can, different people have different things.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. If you could see my screen right now, you would see a sticky note on the corner that says to do. And there's indeed a cross across for you. And I understand completely. It's one of life's small pleasures to be able to just check something is done. So I'm on board with you on that. What's something that people learn you're not that good at that would surprise them?
So people who work with me wouldn't ask this question because they know I'm not good in so many things. It is, I do believe, actually it's more difficult what would I say I'm good at that, frankly. And I think one thing people know is I always like to decide that I'm good at. Or the rest, when it comes to detailed understanding problem deeply, quite often I switch off and that is not my territory because I feel people are so much better. You know, sometimes people try to be constantly better than the people they work with. I think that's rubbish. I mean, that's a job. Therefore, you have people and they should be so much better. I think your job is to allocate a little bit of resources and you're the one, if they need a decision, then you do it. And the last thing is, I always say, listen, all the mistakes are me. You should take the responsibility. But coming back to your question, I'm rubbish in many, many, many things.
Okay. It shouldn't have been a quick fire then. We should have given you a whole 20 minute to expand on.
100%.
Okay. Well, this last one's for me. And as we've alluded to a few times throughout this podcast episode, you and I both have experience in Ireland. As I understand, you got your master's degree in Trinity. I got mine in Galway. So we're on opposite coast.
Galway.
Yes. Yes. So I just want to ask, what's kind of an Irish memory that sticks out to you? It could be Dublin, it could be
Galway, Cork, whatever.
No one else will relate to it. But there is actually, I was twice in Ireland, and the first time I worked as a in a holiday center called Budlands or Mosnay. No one knows it. Besides, you might know it. It is a holiday center for poor people close to Dublin.
Okay,
it's run by. And basically young people around 17, 18. And it was fantastic. I mean, it was the best time I ever had. I was responsible. And I stayed there a year. Yeah. So I was a red coat and help people. So I was responsible telling young girls around 10, which is the nicest princess, and I coached people in soccer. That was fantastic. And during Trinity, I haven't studied at all, honestly. There was that I got a degree is a miracle. I spent most of the, they had debating societies because actually you're quite strong in it, and they had the hist and the phil. And I just remember I played Risk all the time with people drunk and went to these debating competitions. And again, fun. I mean, I really enjoyed. And it was interesting. Then I almost idealized Dublin as this perfect place. And then 5 years ago, I went back to Dublin, and Dublin now is much bigger and quite a lot of tourists there. And I was shocked because it wasn't anymore this old day, old place from 40 years ago.
And yeah. I imagine that's what Galway is now.
I
very much.
I go to Galway.
I was in Galway, and it wasn't that long ago for me. So I do think that maybe Galway has taken that that spot.
Perfect.
But that will be for the next podcast. We can do an all Irish tales of our past, the podcast episode. Well, thank you very much, Friedrich. It's been absolutely for having you on here, and especially for my very first episode here as the host of the U Stars podcast. So I want to thank you again, and it's been a pleasure having you.
Perfect. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Friedrich.